Good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. This morning's learning is sponsored, and the breakfast is sponsored, by Hilary and Sharon Hertan in memory of Sharon's stepfather, Eugene Kalathiyot, at Tzviva Moshe, Allah, Salav, Shalom, and Hashem, Ahav, and Aliyah. Our learning is in his memory. May it continue to be a blessing. Good to see you all this morning. I recognize that some have to flee to assist with the clothing sale shortly at some point, so... Of course, everybody should feel free to leave whenever they need to at any time. But I'll also try to make things as speedy while being clear as possible. I'll do my best. So let's summarize where we're up to. We're on Daf Gimel Amud Bet at the bottom because we're doing Daf Dalet today. To summarize what we've done in Masechta so far, we have done three Mishnayot so far. The first Mishnah asks the basic question, when does Edom Zomamim not work out? Meaning, when do they not get punished with what they intended? And we had five examples by the end of the Gemara. The Mishnah only gave two examples, which is if they accuse somebody of being a Ben Grusha Chalutz, if somebody's halal, we said they don't get that, they get whipped instead. If they accuse somebody of deserving to go to exile, they don't get sent into exile, they get whipped instead. And there were three other cases, Kofar, Eved Ivri, and if they admit it themselves. And across the board, those five cases, we came to the conclusion, they get whipped instead of the intended responsibility. And along the way, we had some discussions about how the justice system works, why this is an exception, why malkut should be used, who the payment might go to, is it a fine, is it compensatory, is it reciprocal, all sorts of questions came up. We then get to the second Mishnah, which was incredibly brief. And I mentioned for a number of commentaries, it's like the hardest piece of the whole Masechta, which I have to complain bitterly about because we actually got through that quite speedily. And I could not get my head in order this week on this stuff, which is why there are these visual aids, which took me way too long to prepare. Not because it's particularly complicated, it's just a lot of bits of information to hold in your head at the same time, and just in text, it can be quite hard to do. So we got to the second Mishnah, which was, what if they accuse, these witnesses accuse somebody of saying, he divorced his wife and didn't pay the ketubah, so he owes her money. Turns out it's not so straightforward because they weren't trying to lose him $200 straight up, because there is a strong likelihood he would have lost that money anyway. Because if he were to die before his wife, or if they were to get divorced, he would have to give her the money. There's only a 1 in 3 chance, they're obviously not equal, but there's only a 1 in 3 chance he wouldn't have to give her the money, which is if he died first. So we've gone from when does it not work out, the punishment, to when do we apply it, but it's quite complicated to calculate because they're only making him lose. Anyone win the lottery last night, by the way?
No.
Nobody won?
1.9 billion.
And they're going to be making so much money this week.
1.9 billion.
Including some of mine, I'm sure. 1.9. All right, great. No one's going to win.
Only getting it when it's two. I don't want to.
Yeah, that's not enough for me, right? So it gets very complicated to assess if they've tried to lose somebody $200 that is only conditionally theirs. And then that was the second mission, and there's only three lines of Gemara, which was, well, how do you assess the odds? Do you ask how much would you pay to have the husband have that $200 in his hands right now with the two-third possibility he'll lose it? Or would you go to say, how much would you pay to have the money on the one-third chance that you're not going to get to use it? Which, again, that's why it might be complicated, because it's mathematical, but it's not that complicated. That was the end of that Mishnah. And then we enter the third Mishnah. And again, the theme, it seems, so far of this perek is adjudicating a just verdict in a difficult case that makes us feel like that's exactly what they deserved. And the undercurrent of this whole Masechta coming off Sanhedrin, the last chapter of Sanhedrin. What's the last chapter of Sanhedrin all about? Anybody know? Chelek is the last chapter, which is all about the afterlife and who gets the afterlife. The kind of coming off of that, we're infused with the spirit that you can't really adjudicate truth and justice here. We just approximate and do our best. And with that spirit, we begin this perek saying, okay, Edom Zomim, there are cases it doesn't work. There are cases it does work, but it's hard to adjudicate how much they owe because it was only a risk. And then the third Mishnah, which we're kind of in the middle of dealing with now, is if somebody said they owe, they borrowed money from them and they owe it all back in 1 month. And the person admits, no, I did borrow money, but it was for a 10-year loan. So they were definitely going to give this money away. It's not like the Ketubah case where there was two-thirds. They were definitely going to give this money away. It was just how long were they going to have it for? And we say you have to go to estimate. You go to the market and say, how much would you pay to have $200 in your pocket for an extra 9 years? And then that's how much they try to lose them, and then the money goes. We also along the way said, this money essentially goes to the bet din unless the accusee goes to court and sues the Edom Zomim and say, I want that money because they caused me emotional harm. In which case, it's a new court case, and then they can have the verdict pass, not only your Edom Zomim, but your chayv money to this person. So it can go from a civil, I guess, to a criminal fine over time, because, or from a criminal to a civil fine, where you've done something wrong to the court, to you owe them money. Now, as a product of speaking about a 10-year loan, the Gemara suddenly thought, hold on a minute, if it's a 10-year loan, you're never going to have to pay it back, because what gets in the way? Shemitah gets in the way, that should cancel the loan. And that kind of gave rise to the discussion of how much can I toy with biblical economic law? Can I just forget about Shemitah? Which, of course, Prosbol, you can. But what about without this formal document? If you lend with a mashgon, it turns out, you give a security. So, you know, I'll borrow 100 grand, have my car. Shemitah doesn't cancel that. And if I say to you, take this loan on condition that you will pay me back after Shemitah, it works. It's only if I say, take this loan and Shemitah will have nothing to do with it, that I can't just eradicate Shemitah conceptually, but I can say, we come to an agreement, it's not going to do anything. We said that's true with overcharging as well. I can say, I'm going to sell you this car, it's only worth 30 grand, but I want 100 grand. And you say, I know you're ripping me off, but I really want the car, take the money. You can't ask for the money back because you knew what you're getting into. You agreed. So it seems like biblical economic law, we have some capacity to engage with it, which again, in some ways, is a branch on this theme of convention is very important when it comes to justice. How do we feel things should be? And if we've come to an agreement, we can reasonably say, I know the biblical law says this, but we came to an agreement. And I know that you try to cost them 9 years of money. How do I adjudicate that? I'll ask people. And there's a huge amount of reliance on human convention. How do we feel things should be to adjudicate justice? And that is the best I can do into where we're about to go. Because today's daf is essentially in two parts. The first part is three cases where Rav gives a ruling which seem completely disconnected. One's going to be about wine falling into a mikveh. One is going to be about a barrel of water falling into the ocean, and one is going to be about ripping open a shirt on Shabbos. And the only thing that seems to be in common in any of these cases is Rav gives a ruling, and then Rav Kahana pipes up and says, that doesn't make any sense, and then there's an answer. And in fact, that's what Rashi says. You may not see. If you've got the Daf Gimel, Ahmed Bet, Rashi on the left-hand side, first word in the line is Chadash. It's right underneath where it says Beit HaTzavar in the bold. It says, Hai denakatla, the reason we're mentioning any of this, Hacha here, Mishum to Amr Rabbi Yehuda La'el, because Rabbi Yehuda said something above, next line, Ve'otiv Rav Kahana, and Rav Kahana responded, so Nakat Nami Lakula, so we gave all the cases. Hanachmili Dishmatin, Damrina Rav Yehuda Ve'otiv Rav Kahana, when Rabbi Yehuda says something, Rav Kahana responds. So we've just got three random cases, Rabbi Yehuda gives a ruling, and then Rav Kahana responds in disagreement, and then we resolve it. Which again, if you're trying to organize legal material, it sounds like, oh, well, they had a conversation, let's stick in all their conversations here. It's not that clear why that would fit. And also, there are other cases where they have conversations. So we're going to try to get some themes here, and it seems to be, the theme is how much we rely on convention. And I don't have a good synonym for convention. If someone has a good synonym to make it clear, that'd be helpful. Convention, basically, it's not inherently the case, but we rely on the way we operate, the way that human beings interact with each other. Standard operating procedure, SOP, is that what that's the acronym?
Protocol.
Yeah, or if I would have had more time or clearer head, I'd think of a good example. But where we all refer to something as something, we know what we mean, even though inherently that's not the case. But it will become clear in the concrete cases we have. So before we turn to that, we've got to finish off the green segment we'll get through rather quickly on Gimel Ahmed Bet, which is about the minimum time to borrow money. If someone comes up to you in shul, in an hour's time and say, can you lend me 10 bucks? And you say, sure, you give them 10 bucks. When are you allowed to ask for the money back? Tuesday? So it turns out you may have to wait 30 days to even ask for the money back. On what basis? That will be the question. Tana, third medium line in green. Tanai was taught, and this again is coming off the talk of Shemitah. Hamavet chaveru stam, if somebody lends somebody money without any condition, I say, here you go, here's 10 bucks. Ein rishay letovo, pakam elam adyom, you cannot ask for it back less than 30 days. You've given them a loan, which seems to be on its face, there is a period of time you can't ask for it back. Sav Rabba Rachana kamei de Rav. Rabba Rachana said before Rav, the Mema, oh, I think this is only talking about Hanemile b'malvesh star, if you do it with a document. If you write a document and say, I owe you 10 bucks signed, the assumption is you can't ask for 30 days. Why would it be different if I just lent you orally or with a star? This is where we're going to lead into, well, sounds like convention again. Because who's going to write down on a piece of paper, you owe me, unless there's something formal here, and you say, this is a serious loan, and you know, in 30 days I want you to come it back. You know, if it's just by mouth though, like come tomorrow, come today, whatever. That's the original assumption, that's not where the Gemara will end up. But if you lend by mouth, the assumption is, lo, you wouldn't have to wait 30 days, claim back tomorrow, it's a less formal loan. Amalei Rav, Haki Ama Chabibi. Rav comes in and says, well, Chabibi said to me as follows, Echad Amalva Bishav, Echad Amalva Peh. It doesn't matter whether it was oral loan or a written documental loan, you cannot claim it back within 30 days. Taninama Haki, the Gemara says, there's a brighter that agrees with this. Hamavit Chayor Stam, if you lend somebody money without any details, En Roshal Tovah B'Hakab B'Shav Shem, you can't claim it back within 30 days, Echad Amalva Bishav, Echad Amalva Peh, whether it's oral or documental. Amalei Shmuel L'Rav. Shmuel said to Rav Matneh, Lo Titiv Achrach, do not get off your feet. Adam Afrashit Leila Hashmata, until you explain the following to me. So we're going to have three lines that repeats the same case and says, you need to explain this to me. You know, don't sit down, meaning I need an urgent response. Mana Hamilta Da'amor, what about the following case makes sense? So Rabbanan, the rabbi said, Hamavet Chaveru Stamin Mashalitov Pachum Lam Yamachem Abishav Echum Abopeh. Why is it that you can't claim it back within 30 days, even if it's an informal loan? Amalei, so he says, there's a biblical proof. Tichtiv, it says in the verse, Krav. Speaking about the Shemitah cycle, it says the seventh year, Shemitah is coming. Now, if you're a rabbi and you're reading this and you think we want the verse to be as brief as possible, what doesn't need to be in the verse? It says the seventh year is coming, the year of the Shemitah is coming. What can we eliminate? Yeah, one or the other. You just say the seventh year is coming, we all know what that is. We say the Shemitah year, why do you need both? So he's going to say it must be Mimashma Shenema Kavishnat Hasheva. Since it says already the seventh year is coming, of course, I already know it's a Shemitah year. Why does it say the extra phrase? The seventh year is coming, which is like the Shemitah year, so to speak. To tell you, there is another Shemitah period. It's not just the seventh year where you're not allowed to oppress people financially. There is another time in life where oppression financially is problematic. And what is this time? If you lend somebody money. So this is a little trivia question. When do we all come up against Shemitah? One is in the seven-year calendaric cycle. And the other, any time you lend somebody money. The first 30 days is a Shemitah cycle where you are not allowed to oppress them. You're not allowed to ask for money. You have to give them freedom with the money. You can't claim it back within 30 days. And how do we know 30 days? Is that just arbitrary? To some degree, but it also appears elsewhere that 30 years is the equivalent of a year. Anyone know where, which context it comes up that 30 days counts as a full year in halachic life? Say again? So, some of the agricultural seasons, if you plant it within or more than 30 days before the new year, that can count as a full year, so agricultural cycle. And there's one other, coronation, that if a king I always say coronated, at which point my father always says, there's no such word, but you know what I mean. And that's what I mean, convention. You can tell me there's no word, but if I say it, you know what I mean. So if a king is coronated 31 days before Rosh Hashanah, that Rosh Hashanah is seen as their second year on the throne, even though they've only been there for 30 days. So 30 days comes up as a whole year in some context. So this is what it means, Shanat HaShemitah. There is a 30-year period you're not allowed to oppress people. Full stop. Now we're going to get right to the next Mishnah, going through three cases, which are going to feel a little heavy, I imagine, which is why I've got these visual aids to assist us. So, the first case is straightforward. Am Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Rav just said in the name of Rav, which again has nothing to do with what we're speaking about, other than the fact that Rav Kahana is going to object to him in a second. HaPoteach Beit HaTzavar B'Shabbat. We've got a clothing sale going on upstairs. Most if I'm not mistaken, all of the shirts up there, you're able to put them on without ripping anything. I imagine that's true. In the old days, how did you know you were not getting a used shirt, but you were getting a new shirt? There would be, what is it called, perforation marks? Be kind of perforation marks in the middle of a piece of fabric. And you'd pull it over your head, and the first time you put it on, and then it would fit your head opening. But it was just a plain piece of fabric, and you'd rip it to put it on. You wouldn't come like so you could button it up or anything. So on Shabbat, let's say you bought a new shirt on Thursday, you put it, I'm going to wear that for Shabbat. You wake up Shabbat morning, oh, I forgot to kind of break it in or wear it in, so to speak, before Shabbat. Can I pull it over my head? I want to wear it for Shabbat. So the Gemara says in the name of Rav, you are not allowed to rip it open on Shabbat. Why? Good question. The Gemara is assuming now the reason you can't is because it's like finishing a vessel called mitaken mane or makib apatish. It's the final thing to do. Exactly leads to the question, can you open a soda can or plastic cap bottles or metal cap bottles? And people have got different views on all of these. Some people think you can open the plastic but not the metal. Anyone know why you might be able to open the plastic and not the metal? Right, the metal, they put the whole thing on. Right, I think I might be wrong. The metal, they put the whole thing on, and then they kind of make perforation marks. So when you open it, that's the first time the cap becomes like a cap. The plastic, they have the ring, and then they put that on, and they melt it together, so it's already a cap. I don't know. You're all, I'm sure, got different practices. And basically, whatever you do, somebody thinks you're fine. Well, not whatever you do, but whatever you do in this context, you think you're fine. Same is true with metal cans. Now, for sure, metal cans, the bit that you snap open wasn't like open and then they put the little bit in there. But there are some views that the whole thing's temporary. You don't open it so then you can use it as a clear. You don't open a can of Coke and then use that can to like water your plants. You know, it's going in the garbage or recycling. So there are different views on that. But that is exactly the case that will come up here. It says, can you rip open this shirt on Shabbos? Rav says, no. And then Rav Kahana says, hold on a minute. How is this different to opening a barrel? And we all know if you've got a barrel that's been sealed, glued shut, you can rip the top off, which is the case basically of the can of Coke or something. You can rip it off. How is that any different? Amalei's response is, Zeh chibur v'zeh einu chibur. Says, well, in the shirt, it's kind of all attached together, but with the barrel, it's not all attached together. Which I'll now ask you, is that compelling on a chemical level? Or is that compelling only on a conventional? Meaning, you can see what he means, that the shirt is kind of interwoven in a more intimate way, and the barrel is like one piece stuck on. But it's not like this shirt grew that way. Somebody took separate threads and put them together, knowing it would be ripped apart. So I took a piece of a lid and a barrel, and I put them together. So on a chemical level, it's not that different, except one's more intense in terms of the way that it's woven. But we all understand, yeah, I can see why there would be a difference between a massive lid being taken off and this fabric being ripped apart. So for me, I think that's where we've kind of got this opening into, are there cases where we try to adjudicate truth on the basis of what seems to be right to us on the basis of convention? So that's the first case. Amrita Marav, we now got the second case, and this is going to take about 15 lines over the page. And it's not that complicated. It's just a lot of different images to hold in the head. And maybe it's just because my head hasn't been clear that I felt the need for this, and you'll just think he's crazy. But hopefully this will be helpful. So I'm Rav Amarav, Rav Yehuda Amarav. So the basic premise needed for this is a mikveh. How much water needs to be in a mikveh? We have one right over there. 40 sa'ah. There needs to be 40 sa'ah. How big is a sa'ah? About half of 2 sa'ah. I've no idea. So there's got to be 40 sa'ah of kosher water in the mikveh. There is far more than 40 sa'ah in that mikveh. And once the 40 sa'ah is in of kosher rainwater, you can then pour in a whole bunch of other water and it doesn't ruin it, which is what happens here. You've got kind of the, I don't know how many of you have been into the mikveh here. There's two rooms. There's the room with all the kind of water gathering stuff, and then there's the actual mikveh. The actual mikveh is like tiled and pretty and heated and warm. And then the room next door is where all the rainwater is gathered, and there's a pipe that goes from the actual halachic mikveh that just connects that water to the actual mikveh. So the mikveh that people are dunking in is not actually pure rainwater. It's mostly water that we fill in from the tap. But
only once the 40 sa'ah is full in the real mikveh, you can then add as much water as you like. But if you don't have 40 sa'ah of rainwater yet, you've got 39. And then you have 3 lug. How much is a lug? Less than a sa'ah, half 2 lug. If you have 3 lug of non-rainwater go in before it's full, that parcels the whole thing. So if the rainwater starts to evaporate and it gets below 40 sa'ah, that's when mikvahs like get shut down until it rains again. I don't know if that's ever happened here. I know places in California where this has happened, where water evaporates and there hasn't rained for like months and months. Actually, I had a friend, a rabbi, who had to go. He's got a lot of time in his hands. He went to Colorado with a couple of his lay leaders, where they got a portion of snow from, I think it's from Vail, is that in Colorado? And they delivered snow by truck to California so they could put it in the mikveh and melt, because they hadn't had rain for such a long time and they needed to have 40 sa'ah. Oh, really? There you go. So sometimes you need to fill that, otherwise you have to shut the whole thing down. And most of that is not rainwater. So the case we have here is the mikveh is not yet full. We're trying to make a mikveh. We've got 35 sa'ah. We need another 5 before we can start adding in whatever we want. But we need 40 of rainwater. We've only got 35. And in the middle, while you're waiting to fill it up, some unhelpful construction worker says, you know what, let's take a break. Let's have a drink. Have some wine. And as they're drinking, somebody trips and drops stuff in. And it's a 3 lug glass. So the question is going to be, if 3 lug of water, manhandled water, falls in, it makes the whole thing parcel. If 3 lug of wine falls in, does that parcel it? No. It has to be only water. So if I drop like a raccoon in, it's not going to parcel it. It's only water that will make it a problem. So now what happens if I've got 3 lug of water and then somebody puts some wine in? So chemically, that's 3 lug of water. But what color is it now? It looks like red wine, deep red wine, let's say. It now looks like wine. So if I drop that in, is that 3 lug of water that is wine colored, or is that wine now? Is it possible or not? And this is a biblical question. Min ha-Torah, can I tovel in this? That's the question. Could the Kohen Gadol tovel in this? Do you need a minion?
Excuse me, we're 4 short for a minion. And Gary Lyman has your tie, and I'm in my shloshim.
Okay.
As you know.
Yeah.
We have 4 people.
Sure. I mean, I'd come, but that would put everything on hold.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. I'll catch you all up, and you get a spare bagel. I think 3 went. Thank you. I'm sure somebody else will pop it in a minute. So again, this is a biblical question. Is this mikveh kosher or not for the Kohen Gadol to go in on Yom Kippur? And we're going to adjudicate this on the basis of, what do you think, is what it comes down to. So, Amri Damara, 4 lines up. Shloshet lugin maim shenafel letochen kurtav yayin. So this is actually on the visual aid page. This is the case on the left. And I've tried, I hope this makes sense. 3 lug, it's up to water. Above the line, there's wine that's gone in. Change the color. So chemically speaking, this is water all the way up to that line with a little bit of wine. So he says, this is the case. Umarehen, first word in the line is marehen, kamarehen. And it looks like wine. V'naflu l'mikveh, and it falls into a mikveh. Lo pasluhu. Says it does not parcel it, even though chemically speaking, this has got enough water to make this mikveh parcel, because it looks like wine, it doesn't parcel it. Matkiv la Rav Gana. Rav Gana respond, V'chima bein zele meit sava. How is that different to colored water? And he says, we all know, did none in the name of Rabbi Yossi Omer, he says, meit sava poselin et ha-mikveh b'shloshet lugin. This is the right-hand case in that top box. You've got 3 lugin of water, color above it, exactly the same chemical buildup as the case on the left, but one's colored water on the right, and the other's now colored water with wine. It says, how is that any different? And this is Rav's answer. Amale Rava, Rava responds in his defense. Hatam maya detzava amikri. Well, what do people call the thing on the right? What do people call that? They call that colored water. Hacha chamra meziga mikri. What do they call the thing on the left? Diluted wine. So he's now adjudicating whether the mikveh is kosher or not based on what do people call what just fell in. It's nothing to do with the chemistry. It's kind of to do with how it looks and more to do with what we call it. Vahatni, but we've got a brighter, Rav Chiya, Haridu et ha-mikveh, where Rav Chiya, this is the bottom box, on that first page. Rabbi Chiya has exactly the same case where there's wine above the line, and he says that parcels a mikveh. So I've put in English at the bottom underneath each of those pictures. For Rav, everything's by convention. How do I refer to this? And then on the bottom, it seems to be based only on the chemical understanding. Is there 3 lug of water? If there's 3 lug of water, it's parcel. Whereas Rav says, no, it doesn't matter. It could be 85 lug of water. But if it looks like wine and we call it wine, it doesn't parcel the mikveh. That seems to be his view. Now, Amar Rava, even though Rav Chiya disagrees, Rava says, lo kasha, it doesn't matter that Rav Chiya disagreed in a brighter, which would be more authoritative than Rav Yehuda. Why does it matter? Ha Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, ha Rabbanan. Because there's an argument, and this is on page 2 of the visual aid. There is a similar argument between two Mishnaic figures, the Rivan, Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, and the Rabbanan, and the Chachamim, the sages at the bottom. We've got exactly the same debate, so it's perfectly reasonable to have Rav Chiya have one view and Rav have another because they're following different traditions. Now, this is where it gets kind of weedy because it's not exactly the same case given in that Mishnah between Rav Yochanan ben Nuri and the Rabbanan, and we have to kind of infer how they would feel. And what the bottom line, did somebody come upstairs? Somebody else came? Great, thank you. So what will emerge bottom line after the next 10 lines is the Gemara is trying very, very hard to show that Rav is as maximal a view as possible, that everybody follows the idea that it's convention, that it doesn't matter about the chemical makeup. As long as we say that's wine and we say that's water, that's how we adjudicate. What happens if milk fell in? Let's say you've got 2 lug of water. 1 lug of milk falls in. What does it look like now? Does it look like milk? Okay, I don't know. Let's assume it looks like water, because that's what the assumption is. Water was very murky back then. It wasn't like nice filtered New York water. So you've got 2 lug of water, 1 lug of milk. It's kind of weak milk and strong water, and it kind of looks like water. Chemically speaking, there is not enough water to invalidate the mikveh. But if everything's just about how we refer to it, people would look at that and they say, yeah, that's water. And that's enough to parcel the mikveh. That's going to be one case. Which, again, seems rather radical, because chemically there isn't enough water. But it's all about convention, is what is going to emerge out of the discussion. So, Ditnan, there is a Mishnah, and this is Rava trying to prove that the argument between Rav and Rav Chiya, between chemistry and convention, is just a reflection of an earlier argument. So let's turn Ditnan. It was taught in the Mishnah, Shosha Lug in mind. We've got 3 lug of water onto Dalet Amud Aleph. If you've got 3 lug of Mayim, Chaser Kurtav, missing a drop, which is why on page 2 of this visual aid, I'm sorry, left-hand side of the top box, you can see the whole measurement only goes up to 3, which is different to the first page. The first page, it went over 3. We're now talking about a case where, by the end of all the spillage, there's only 3 lug in this container, and water goes up to the line. So you don't have 3 lug of water, and then wine falls in. So chemically speaking, there's no reason this should invalidate a mikveh, but there's no water. And what about convention? It looks like wine, so therefore it shouldn't validate it on that level either. So that's not so complicated as a case. So you've got 2 lug of water minus a drop. Shanach velatoka kut of yayin, and a drop of wine falls in. Amara kamara yayin, so it looks like wine. Naflu mikveh lo paslu, it falls in a mikveh, it's not pasul. And that makes sense on every level. It's not enough water, it doesn't look like water, full stop. V'chein, and this is the complicated case, gimel lug in mayin. If you've got 3 lug of mayim, chaser kutav, missing a drop, shenafel letocha kutav chalav, which a drop of milk falls in, umar kamara mayin, and it looks like water. This is the case on the right. I actually did make it blue initially, because that's what water looks like in New York. And I thought, yeah, that's not, I guess it was more murky. So it looks like water, but it's still chemically not enough water. What's the conclusion? Lo pasluhu, that's the view of the Rabbanan, it doesn't parcel it. Which sounds like, at the moment, he's all about chemistry. You don't have enough water in the first case, you don't have enough water in the second case. They look different, it's true, but it's all about chemistry, what it sounds like for the sages, which is actually the bottom of the page, the Rabbanan. And the reason I put it at the bottom is because it reflects the view of Rav Chiya. That's the claim of Rava. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, Omer HaKol HaLachamara, color is king, everything follows the color. So he's saying, Rava, that's exactly the same debate between our Rav and Rav Chiya. You've got the Rivan up here, says it follows the view, which is, again, the most astonishing claim is, even if it's chemically not enough water, if it looks like water, it's going in. So I guess, what happens if it's vodka? What if it's 3 lug of vodka?
Well,
I guess it looks like water, but if you were to sip it, you'd say, oh, that's not water. So it's not quite at all looks like it. You know, there's all sorts of things that could look like water, but it has to kind of have the properties of water enough that you'd sip it, you'd taste it, you'd feel it, and say, yeah, that's water. Now, the Gemara, and this is, I apologize, that highlight was incorrect. The green should not have started until Hamabayale on that second line. From here until the yellow in the middle where it says Avru Yoram Arav, is the Gemara trying to adjudicate, is it possible that this debate in the Mishnah between Ravan and Rabbanan actually is not the same debate? And actually, even the Rabbanan, who it seems to be it's just about the chemistry, actually think color is very important too. And the only way to make that case is to say, maybe that's not the text of the Mishnah. Maybe the Mishnah doesn't say that. Which is why if you look on the third page, we've now got another chart with a different case, where the case on the left, how high does the liquid go? Goes above 3. But the case of the milk and water only goes to 3, which would mean the Mishnah is not talking about symmetrical cases, where the first case is, if you've got 3 lug of water and then some wine falls in, is it a problem? And if you've got less than 3 lug of water and milk falls in, is it a problem? Which is a very kind of lopsided Mishnah. It happens to be that's how the Mishnah appears in the Sechet Mikvot. That is the way the text is. But the Gemara says, maybe that's not the case. And again, if that's the case, we've got the Rabbanan begin. Say 3 lug of water and you put wine in, no problem. Chemically, is there enough water in there to invalidate? Yes. And the rabbis say it doesn't invalidate. Why? Because color seems to be important. Even for the rabbis, color is important, is what is the point that the Gemara is about to try to make, which is maybe Rav's view that convention is important is across the board. Everybody, even the sages, agree to that. And the only case that there's disagreement between Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and the Rabbanan is in the case when it's less than 3 lug, and then it fills up with milk. Does it invalidate or not? According to the Rabbanan, it does not invalidate. Now, why would it not invalidate? Because there's not enough water. So they seem to be concerned that it's got to be chemically enough water and it has to look like water. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri says, color is the only thing that matters. So it doesn't matter chemically if there's enough water or not. So the debate is very narrow. But everybody agrees it has to look like water to be a problem, even if chemically it is water. Which again, what are we honing in on? You've got a chemical object in front of you, a container full of liquid. And I could very easily, with modern technology, tell you how much water is in there. I could look at the atoms, I could look at the particles, I could see how much hydrogen and oxygen is in there. I don't know what the makeup of wine is. And I see how much wine is in there. But that's not relevant. That's not relevant. Even though we know the capital T truth can be adjudicated through mechanical means, I can analyze this. That's not relevant. Is relevant, how do we treat it as human beings? Which again is the theme of justice in this chapter, which is capital T truth is impossible. We operate by convention. What do we feel is fair? What do we feel works? We're never going to hit the truth when it comes to who's done wrong and who's done right and how we should adjudicate what's deserved. Do they deserve the death penalty? I don't know. I'm not in their head. I don't know what God thinks. I don't know if they've done kindness I don't know about. I don't know if they've got sickness. We just conventionally operate. And here again, is an argument between Rav and Rav Kahana, where there's debate about chemistry or convention, and the Gemara is trying to establish as much as possible. Maybe everybody agrees about convention. Even in this case, you've got a Kohen Gadol who needs to go to Mikveh, to go into the Kodesh Kodashim, and you're saying it's kosher. Even though 3 lug of water fell in, but we call it wine because it was red, he can go in, not a problem. Even though capital T truth, again, water went in. That's what it seems to be. The debate, so I'm going to try and get through these lines. Rabbi Yochanan, Hamabayah. So what was established so far? Rava, this is the first one line is Acha Amare, in the middle, Hamabai. So Rava tried to say the argument between Rav and Rav Kahana is the same argument that we have in a different Mishnah I've just showed you. Now the Gemara says, hold on a minute. Rav Papa said that that debate in the Mishnah is not the same as ours. And maybe Rav follows everybody, including the rabbis, because they care about color too. Hamabai by Rav Papa. Hold on a minute, Rav Papa asked a question about that Mishnah. Dabai Rav Papa, he asked as follows. He said, are you right, Rava, in the following way, Rav Tani Chasa Kurtav Beresha, that it is the similar case between the milk and the wine case, where there's less than 3 lug, Ava Shlosha lug in the Tamakama Pase, but if there was 3 lug of water chemically, it would have been a problem. Vat Rabbi Yochanan Elamei Makol Achamare, and Rabbi Yochanan comes along and disagrees. That's what you would say. The Rav Amar Korachin and Ben-Nuri, and Rav only follows Rabbi Yochanan and Ben-Nuri then, and that's the same debate as you think to be happening. Oh, or maybe page 3 of our visual aid is true.
Dilma Rav lo tanichas akur debereisha. Maybe it doesn't say that first case of wine, there was less than 3 lug, but there was 3 lug of water. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, ki palig asefa upalig. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri only disagrees in the case of the milk, when it was under 2 lug, under 3 lug, and he thinks it possible anyway because of the color. For Rav da'amak adivra akol, and in that case, Rav, who thinks convention and color is important, would be in line with everybody. And the Gemara responds and says, you're telling me Rav Papa asked that question when Rava didn't take that view. So the Gemara says, yeah, la Rav Papa and by la Rava Pshitale. Rav Papa had a question. Rava didn't have a question. He didn't think that was the issue. He thought this is the same mistake. And this is where, hopefully it hasn't been too winding and complicated, the Gemara is going to suggest that when we're in the realm of convention, where does this lead? If we entertain doubt in the case of law and justice and truth, we've got none to stand on, and it kind of almost like the Gemara implodes here. V'amar Rav Yosef la shmile hashmaida. Rav Yosef says, I've never heard such a thing. I don't know what's going on. Now it turns out Rav Yosef suffered from acute memory loss at the end of his life, and there are many cases in the Gemara where he appears and says, I don't know anything about this, and his students say, well, actually, you gave a shir about it last week, or you spoke about it last year, or you've written about it here, and he gets reminded. And many have observed that Rav Yosef at the end, I can't remember which Masechta comes up, when somebody says, now that this great sage has died, there's no humility left in the world. And Rav Yosef turns around and says, no, there is, because I'm still here. And everybody says, hold on a minute, that doesn't seem very humble. And his observation is, and many of the commentaries, you know, he says, I'm still here, not that I'm humble, but I used to know everything, and I've forgotten everything. And I remind people that nothing is our own doing. Everything is dependent on things external to us, at the deepest level, dependent on God, and we can lose everything in an instant. So people can see me, and they think, I could lose everything too. So that's where the humility in the world. So Rav Yosef appears and says, I haven't heard anything about this case. Amalei Abaya, Abaya says to him, At Amart La Nihalan, you did tell us about it, V'hachi Amart Nihalan, and this is what you told us about this case. The Rav lo tanechasekud, the Bereshav, Rav Yochanan, Asefa, Palig, Rav Da'amak, Devrekol, full stop. You adjudicate that everybody follows convention. So again, this is kind of the ultimate, we just lose track of everything. If we don't have firm capital T truth, I don't remember anything. And Abaya kind of comes along to put a stop to it and says, no, you told us, everybody follows convention, everybody agrees it's across the board. That's how the world works. You want to know how the world works? We just have to use convention. There's no other way to make things function. Full stop. Third case. Completely disconnected, where Rav Yudah makes a point and Rav Kahana objects. And this is the case I was thinking about over the summer when I was looking at the Mediterranean Sea. Amru Amar Rav, Chavit Melea Mayim, if you've got a barrel full of water, Shenaflu Yam HaGadol, that falls into the Mediterranean Sea, Hatov Al Shamlo Atala Tefillah, if you then go in and do Tefillah, anyone ever use the ocean as a mikveh? There you go. Were you kicked off the beach? There you go. There, I know that there are some Chabad shlichim. They get sent everywhere. You know, you pull the right straw, you end up in Hawaii. You pull the wrong straw, you can end up in Siberia. I don't think there's Chabad in Siberia. But there are Chabads in places where people go to visit for tourist purposes, but there's no, like, Jewish infrastructure. And my wife's grandmother said she had a friend went on her shlichut somewhere. They didn't have a mikveh anywhere near them. And she actually had to take a helicopter ride to the nearest coast. And it wasn't like there was a beach, it was like a cliff. She had to like be lowered down off a helicopter, which sounds, not true to be honest, but sounds like a crazy situation. But of course the ocean functions as a mikveh. It's not rainwater yet, but it will be. It's natural occurring water. So what happens if I do mikveh in a barrel though? That doesn't work, that's manhandled water. So if I pour a barrel of water into the ocean, where's that water now gone? Anyone familiar with the ocean water mechanics? I remember having to do this in geography in high school. You know there are waves in the water, so it looks like the whole ocean's moving. Turns out waves is just the movement on the surface. If you go down under the surface, very little movement in the water. It's just the wind, and it causes undulations on top. But it's not like the whole ocean moves and then goes back. It's just movement. Again, I don't need to stand here doing the Macarena for you. So if I pour a barrel of water into the ocean, has it moved? Is it in the same place? I don't know. The assumption that Gemara have is, we've got strong enough instinct that it's in the same place. And if you then dunk in exactly the same place, it don't work. And again, this is coming to the point where looks can be deceiving.
you know, in a massive ocean, you pour water in, our assumption is it's diffused. You know, if you talk about batel b'shishim, this is an ocean, and you pour a barrel in, it should be done. And yet we're saying, we assume the water's there, even though it might not look like it. Chayshinan, because we're worried, l'shlosha lugin shlo yibim makom achad, that maybe that there are three lug to parcel your experience in that place. V'davka l'yam ha'gadol d'kai, v'kaima, but this is only true if it's in the ocean. Avol nara ba'alma lo, but if it's in a river, we don't assume that. Why do we not assume that it's a problem in a river? Because there the water does move. It's not a stationary body of water with just the top. The whole river's moving the whole time. So, if you pour a barrel in, it's assumed to be moving. Tanya namahachi, the Gemara taught this in a brayta as well. Chavit meleya yayin shenaf le'yamagadol, if you pour in a barrel of wine into the sea, hatov hashem la'antelo tefila, it doesn't work. Which again, you'd assume, well, I could see that. Maybe it's white wine. Or maybe, even though it's diffused, we assume maybe it's still there. Maybe there's three lugin in one place causing a problem. And also, if you've got a loaf of truma bread, and it falls in, it's tame. Now, why is that any different to saying that tefillah doesn't work? The Gemara is going to say, well, if I'm doing tefillah, am I tame or tahor at the time? I'm tame. So I want to become tahor, so I jump in. And the Gemara says, no, that doesn't work. You can't get rid of your tumah status. So you might think it's just saying, we're not sure, so we just fall back on the default, which is you were tame. But then if you've got a tahor piece of truma bread and you drop it in, we should say, we're not sure, so let it keep with what it was. And the Gemara is saying, no, we are so sure that this is a problem that we're willing to change the status to tame, which again comes back to the point that we're adjudicating this by guesswork. We don't have proof that this was tame, but we're going to say you drop truma in there, it's now tame, full stop. Once we've determined that this is a problem, we have the power legally to say this is the new truth, and it can make everything else tame, even if we weren't initially sure. My v'chein, why are you teaching the case of truma? You might have thought, hakam oki agavra achazke, you would just say you go by your default and you went in tame, so you come out tame, haka oki truma achazke, so you might think, so truma went in tahor, it should come out tame, kamashablan, so teachers just know it becomes tame through this process. So, full stop, end of discussion. This all came from a Mishnah talking about they accuse him of owing money within 30 days, and somehow we ended up in the Mediterranean Ocean with a barrel of wine. But again, it seems to be adjudicating the issue of, it seems so arbitrary that you're going to the marketplace and saying, how much would you pay to have money for 9 years? That's what you're going to punish them legally in a court of law? The answer is, yes, we adjudicate things by convention all the time. Even when you're talking about barrels of water and loaves of bread, and you'd think, this is very easy to assess. Get some instruments in there, figure out what the truth is, and we say, no, we follow convention. Ripping a shirt, opening a barrel, it's all, what do you think, collectively, is how we adjudicate life. And that works in justice, and it works in ritual law. Next case, new Mishnah. And we're going to have two debates in this Mishnah, only one of which we're going to deal with on the next side. And the next side, I keep saying this, which I may regret, is relatively smooth going. I'll apologize for churning out Aramaic at high speed, but it's, conceptually it flows quite neatly, so it'll be quite quick. And none of it is practical in terms of how do we rule. What's going to emerge in this Mishnah is a debate between Rabbi Meir and the sages. Now, there is a principle in Jewish law that if you have done a sin that requires more than one punishment, meaning if I, none of you, but I take an arrow, and I'm using an arrow instead of a gun because I want it to not feel contemporary. If I take an arrow and I shoot it and it kills my friend, but my friend was not naked, so what has it done at the same time? Ruin the shirt. So if the family were to take me to court, say, put him to death, and by the way, he ruined his shirt. I'm sure you've all heard the joke about the grandmother standing at the side of the ocean and her grandson falls in and she prays, save him, please, and he comes back and he says, he had a hat. And that's the same, like, that's what it'd be like going to court saying, kill my husband and the shirt. You know, that wasn't a cheap shirt either. So what's the halachic principle? Lo kan le b'derama minei, the biggest punishment is what you get. You can't get taken to court over the shirt if you're being, for the same act, being punished with the death penalty. Which is, you know, if you're going to kill someone, then kill them in their best clothes. Because, you know, may as well take as much as you can and not get fined for it. So you can't have two punishments for the same act, it seems, unless it's otherwise instructed. But Rabbi Meir is going to suggest you can have more than one punishment for the same act. And that's not halacha lemaisa, that's not how we rule, but we're going to have a daf trying to figure out where does he get this from. And then we'll get to A second case, which is a principle already came up on the first stuff, which is if I do a sin that has no act, called a lav she'ein bo maaseh. Anyone give an example of a transgression no act is involved?
Testifying
is the example that came up, because speaking isn't really an act. This comes up with kids all the time. You know, it'll come up at home if I say, like, what did you do to your sister? So, I didn't do anything. I just said. It's like, okay. Right, so we can understand, again, conventionally, that speaking doesn't feel like you did something. So if you testify falsely, you shouldn't get punished because there's no act involved. But Rabbi Meir is going to seem to find a view that actually, even if you don't do anything, no act is involved, you're going to get whipped. The classic case of a lav she'ein bo maaseh, of a negative precept where there's no act, is actually the case of notar. Anyone familiar with notar? Notar is leftover korban that you have to eat. So if you bring a korban to the Bet Mikdash, there's a window when you're allowed to eat it. Sometimes a day, sometimes 2 days, sometimes a day and a half. And it's not like, oh, you have to eat in this time and then it's off and you throw it out. You have to eat it in that time. And it's a transgression to leave any of it over. You have to finish it all. I don't know if any of you grew up in these houses, like, finish everything on your plate. Have you ever seen the movie Matilda, where she makes the rather heavy young man finish a whole massive chocolate cake in a horrific way? But the halacha, this is a way to get more people involved with your korban, because you need to finish it on time. Now, there is a transgression to not finish it. That is, by definition, a passive thing. I'm sitting here, I'm doing nothing, I'm not eating my korban, and that's a transgression. So that's the classic case of no act is involved, so you don't get punished. Which would make you think, so what's the big deal? So that's a separate discussion. But it's going to seem for Reb Meir, you do get punished, even for a non-active transgression. So let's see. Eden Anu Bish Ploni, we testify. This is another case of Zomimim who testify. Be'ish Ploni about a certain person. Shechayv lechaveru 200 zuz. Owes 200 bucks to somebody else. V'nim su Zomimim. And then it turns out that they are schemers. There was no such debt. Lokin umashalmim, they get whipped and they have to pay. And so far it sounded like to us they just have to pay. That's what they intended. They get what they intended. So this is the view of Reb Meir, is they have to pay because that's what they intended, but they also get whipped because of the separate problem, they testified falsely. So you get whipped for testifying falsely and you have to pay because you're zomimim. Shlo Hashem amavim l'dei makot l'dei mitar shlomim, because it comes from a separate source. One comes from the fact that you schemed, that's why you have to pay 200. And one is from the fact that you lied under oath, that's why you get whipped. Divrei Reb Meir, that's Reb Meir. Chachamim are in the sages, say, kol mashamei niloke, full stop. Chachamim say, no, if you're paying, you don't get whipped. You get one punishment, and that's it. Second case in this Mishnah, which we'll talk about next time. Midin anu bish ploni, we testify about somebody, shuchayv malkus arbaim, that they deserve 40 lashes. So you'd think, okay, what do they scheme to do? 40 lashes, what should they get back in response? 40 lashes. Reb Meir is going to say, not only did you intend that, but you also lied under oath, so you should get 40 more lashes. V'nim suzomim, lokin shmonim. You should get whipped 80 lashes. Mishum lo tana berecha and shecha, because there's a verse that says, don't testify falsely. Mishum v'asim lo kashez amam, and you schemed it. Reb Meir says, you get 80 lashes. Which again, of course, you then go to the doctor, and the doctor has to assess how many you could take, and there's a maximum that you can take. V'chachamim omrim, the sages say, unlokin el arabayim, the sages say, you only get 40 lashes. Good, so we'll come to that. So let's turn over the page as the Gemara now tries to figure out, for a start, where on earth Reb Meir comes from. And they're going to have two different routes, which gets quite far afield, but hopefully the introduction helps. Vishlama Rabbanan. The Gemara begins by saying, Chachamim makes perfect sense in every case. You get one punishment. If you're paying, you don't get whipped, and you only get whipped 40 times, because testifying is not an active love. So you shouldn't get... All that makes sense. And the first case, the Gemara says, makes sense. Kedei rishato ketiv. It says, when you get punished for your wickedness in the singular. Mishum risha echat ata mechayvo. V'yeta mechayvo mishtei rishayot. You only get one punishment when you go to court. You can't say, right, give him lashes, execute him, and before you execute him, take money out of his bank to pay for that. Meaning, he's done something wrong. We're given the verdict. You can only give one punishment. That seems to be the halachic perspective. But ela Reb Meir maitama. What is Reb Meir talking about? Why do you get hit and have to pay? Amar Ullah, and now that I think about it, there's only one response the Gemara gives. This is the justification for Reb Meir, because there is a case where the Torah is very explicit that you get two punishments. Gama Memotzi Shemra, you learn it from Motzi Shemra. Anyone familiar with what Motzi Shemra is, the case?
It's an unusual case where a man has got married to a young girl, and he goes to court after they're married and claims that between our engagement and our marriage, she was disloyal. She committed adultery while after we were engaged but before we were married. Turns out that's not true. So it's not like he was scheming, he didn't get together with anybody, but he did lie under oath, and it's a very specific species of lie. It's not just made up, you know, oh, I was in the room and it was $200, not $100. It's this young lady who is now entirely under my care, I'm going to invent something to exploit and turn her situation into capital for me. And in that case, Ma, Motsi, Shemra, in that case, Loka Mashalem, you get whipped and there's a fine. And the Torah is explicit about that. You get punished by court and you have to pay money. Who does the money go to?
Her father.
We can talk about that another time as well. But her father gets the money. Afkol Loka Mashalem, he says, so that's my basis. Motsi, Shemra, you get two punishments. So every case, you should get two punishments. Mala Motsi, Shemra, the Gemara says, you're saying you should learn Motsi, Shemra, Ken Knas. That's clearly a fine. You have to pay money. You didn't take money from her. It's a fine. So you can't learn that to Adam Zomimim, unless you're following the view that Adam Zomimim is a Knas, which was Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva, Dama Adam Zomimim Knas, full stop. So that's kind of like the bottom first case of the Mishnah. Rabbi Meir says you get two punishments. The Gemara says, where do you get that from? It says Motsi, Shemra. It says Motsi, Shemra is a Knas. So is Adam Zomimim a Knas. Which makes it sound like now you've got two cases where you get more than one punishment, and maybe it's more broad as well. Full stop. And now open big square parentheses, which will close again after the yellow at the bottom of this page. The Gemara says, oh, since you've mentioned Ulla, who has got this untraditional view that you can have two punishments at once, we're going to mention something else that some people say. Ulla didn't say that. Ulla said this, which is also unconventional, non-traditional, which is you get punished even if there's no act. Love, shame, but masa. So again, this is big parentheses, doesn't conceptually link up, apart from there'll be some common references, but it's just there's a non-traditional view Ulla's been associated with here that you get punished in more than one way. And some people say that's not exactly what the case was. It was this case where he's also non-traditional, where he says you get punished even if there wasn't an act. So let's see. Ika d'matne lahada Ulla aha. Some people say this is where Ulla's view came up in the following case. The Tanya was taught on a brighter. The bride taught, Lo tetirim memenu ad boker, do not leave over your sacrifice until the morning. V'anot memenu ad boker, and if you leave it over till the morning, what do you have to do with it, by the way? If you left it over, you have to burn it. So this is a different kind of transgression, where if I steal money from somebody, what does the Torah say I have to do? Give the money back. So do I get whipped for stealing money? No, there's a fine. I have to pay it back because the Torah says, don't do this, and if you do, this is the remedy. So the assumption is if the Torah gives a remedy, you don't need a punishment. It's telling you what to do. So here it said, don't leave over the notar, and if you do, you should burn it. And that's called a lav hanitak la'ase, which is a transgression. Nitak means kind of uprooted, which is then uprooted with a remedy. So the response is, bar katov liten ase achalot ase. The Torah gives an instruction, a remedy, a positive one after the transgression, Lomar, to tell you, Shein Lokin Elav de Rabbi Yehuda. You said, and that's why you don't get whipped for notar. Which sounds like what? It's not because, right, it sounds like if it wasn't for the fact that the Torah gave you a remedy, you'd get whipped, even though there's no act. It's completely passive. Rabbi Kiva Omer, Rabbi Kiva says, Lo min Hashem who's there. That's not the reason you don't get whipped. El Mashum Dahavale Lav Shein Boase. Bechol Lav Shein Boase, Ein Lokin Elav. It's because there's no act, and if there's no act, you don't get whipped. So the Gemara now says, full stop, let's reflect on this. We've got a debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, we get. There's no act, you don't get whipped. Rabbi Yehuda says, you only don't get whipped with notar because there's a remedy. Michlal, which sounds like Rabbi Yehuda, Sava, Lav Shein Boase, Lo Ken Elav. You do get whipped, even if it's entirely passive. And now the Gemara is going to spend 10 lines trying to figure out, on what basis can you whip somebody if they haven't done an act? Manale. Where does this come from? And this is where Amar Ulla says, oh, this is where somebody heard Ulla say something that was untraditional. And again, looking at the face of it, this has got really nothing to do with what we said Ulla said. But I'm sure we've all had cases where we said, oh, I heard this person say that. And then someone said, no, they didn't say that. You're right, this is something crazy. But it was nothing to do with that. This is what they said. And this is essentially when it's not connected, apart from a couple of references, and it's non-traditional. But it's not in any way the same claim. So Amar Ulla says, where does Rabbi Yehuda know you get whipped even if there was no act. Gama mamotzei shemra. He learns it from the case of motzei shemra. Mamotzei shemra lav shem bo aser lo kin alav. Just as motzei shemra, you're just speaking in court. You're just using words, and yet you get punished. Af kol lav shem bo aser lo kin alav. You get whipped. And now the Gemara is going to say, mamotzei shemra, shkein lo kin mishalem. You can't use motzei shemra as the basis. There are two punishments with motzei shemra. You get whipped in the Torah, and you have to pay. So that's not like a standard case that you can learn to everything else. Ela amar Rish Lakish. Rish Lakish said, I've got a different case where you can know that you do get whipped even if there's no act. Gamar me edim zomamim. So this ties back into our case. Edim zomamim, there's no act. You stood in court and you spoke, and yet you get malkas. Ma edim zomamim, lav shein bo aser lo kin alav, av kol shein ben lav nas nasav. So edim zomamim is the default basis, the standard case that proves you get whipped in the case of notar and everything else if there's no remedy given. That's what it sounds like. But there's something unusual about Edom Zomim that the Gemara is going to say. You can't use that as a standard case either. Now, what is not required in Edom Zomim? Hasra. That's what we're going to come to. So usually, if I want to take you to court and for murder, it's something very important. Otherwise, you'll never get convicted. And it sounds like a technicality. And of course, this is true all the time in law. When you've got prosecutors doing a case, they have to be very careful not to use certain evidence if it's inadmissible. If there's a rule called fruit of the poisonous tree, and I'm familiar with this legal concept, fruit of poisonous tree. If a document was stolen illegally, and as a product of that document, you found another piece of evidence because you found this stolen document says he was here on this day, and then you go and interview somebody about it, and then the defendant says, how did you know to speak to that person? He said, oh, we spoke to that person on the basis of this document. How'd you get that document? Oh, somebody stole it. So that was illegal. That makes that fruit the poisonous tree, and everything is scrubbed from the record. That's inadmissible. So it's a technical meaning, but it's true. You know I spoke to him, and that's not pertinent, but still, there are legal procedures. So in Jewish law, there's a legal procedure of hasra. You need to warn somebody if you want them to be convicted. So if somebody's got a knife in their hand, and they're about to thrust it into somebody's chest, and they don't get warned in advance of what they're doing is wrong, they cannot be convicted. You can have the whole room watch it happen. Everybody's so shocked by the event, no one says anything. They walk free, kind of hypothetically speaking. But if you jump in and you say, don't kill him, that's really bad. It says in the Torah, Lo Tirzach, you'll get killed and executed. And they say, I know and I don't care. Boom. You've had the hasra, they've had the warning, they've got full intent. You can have the verdict. Now, Edom Zomamim is the exception. No hasra is needed. And there are debates as to why there's no hasra needed. In some ways, it's not practical, because hasra needs to be in a certain time frame. I can't say right now to all of you, there is a law in the Torah, don't kill. And if you kill, you get punished. And then in 3 years' time, somebody commits murder and say, oh, they got hasra because they heard a shear 4 years ago. It has to be like in the moment of the act. So if you're Edom Zomim, you're scheming, when's the act? Or when's the sin? Is it when you testify? And does that mean every 3 seconds I have to interrupt your testimony to say, by the way, this better not be a scheme, because if you scheme, it's wrong. 10 seconds, by the way, when's the warning? So it technically might be impossible to give it, but across the board, you get caught as schemers and punished even without a warning. So the Gemara is about to say that can't serve as a standard case to prove you get whipped when there's no act, because it's a unique instance. There's no warning required. Mal Edom, this is the first wide line in the middle. Mal Edom Zom Shekein, Ein, first word line is Srichin, next line. Ein Srichin Hasra. But how can you use that as a standard case to prove you get whipped if there's no act? There's no Hasra needed. Motzi Shemra Yochiach, V'chazer Hadin. And then it goes round and round. So it says, oh, we've now got two exceptional cases where you get whipped even though you didn't do an act. One is Motzi Shemra, you get whipped even though you do an act. But we said that's not standard. What's not standard by Motzi Shemra? Two punishments, right? So you can't use that as a standard. We said, okay, Edom Zomim, you get whipped even though there's no act. We said, but that's not standard. What's not standard about Edom Zomim? No Hasra. So in other words, so you've got two exceptional cases in different ways that both get whipped even though there's no act, so they can prove each other that it can't be what's unique about them because it's present in both cases. Even though they're both unique, they're unique in different ways. So it says, Lori Izekari Izev, Lori Izekari Izev, that uniqueness of that is not the same as this, and the uniqueness of that is not the same as this. Hatsada Shava Behen, what do they have in common? Lav Shein B'Maseh V'Lokin Alav, that there's no act and you get whipped. Av Kol Shein L'B'Maseh V'Lokin Alav, so do everything where there's no act, you get whipped too. And now the Gemara is going to try again to break down this comparison and say they're still, maybe they're both unique in a similar way, enough that they're both non-standard.
Mala Hatzala Shavajat Mashin Kanas. But maybe they're both considered a Kanas. With the Mercy Shemri said that's a Kanas. Adam Zomim for Rabbi Akiva, it's a Kanas. So maybe they're unique as well in that way. Lo Kashya. No, that's not a problem because Rabbi Yehuda lo Savalak Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yehuda, it happens, doesn't follow Rabbi Akiva. And it's not a Kanas for him, so they're not unique. They're not united in that way. Okay, the Mara says, okay, let's find another way. Ella, Malat, Sala, Shavashab, and maybe there's another thing they have in common, Shekein Yesh Bem Sad Chamer, that they both have a stringency. One doesn't need Hasra, and one you get punished in two ways. So even though they're unique in different ways, their uniqueness is similar enough in that they're both stringencies. And maybe that means it shouldn't apply across the board. The Gemara kind of loses its patience. It says, Rabbi Yehuda, Sala, Chamer, Lai Parach. He's not concerned. That's not for him. That's not a problem. Full stop. And then the red we'll do next week is in the picks up on the next part of the Mishnah. But what we've established so far, again, none of it is halacha l'maaseh because we rule it needs to have an act, has to be a lav yesh bo maaseh, and we say you can only get punished once. So what the Gemara seems to be doing at this point is drawing our attention to the fact that there are different views when it comes to punishment. Rabbi Meir is a strong view. He often takes the default ruling, he often wins the day. And he has a view, you get whipped and you have to pay. And he takes a view that you get whipped even if there's no act. And Adam Zomimim is the standard case, together with Motzi Shemra, that proves the case. We're not going to have that view, bottom line. But we are... excuse me. But we are going to see that there are different positions on this. It makes it more complicated, but I hope that was relatively clear. And look, we nearly did a hold off today. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you for your sacrifice. Those of you who had to leave, I know that's not easy and can be frustrating. So thank you for that. And in the meantime, I'll be very happy to share the recording so you can suffer again during the week. But in the meantime, I wish you all a wonderful day. Next week, we'll pick up bottom of Dalet Amud Bet. Well, we'll push forward. Thank you. Torah.